It is.
And when you are a 15-year-old girl reading that book.
Oh, I'm sure you were like, you're like, well, I'm going to put on some Cure and I'm gonna put on my blackest clothes.
I was wearing my blackest clothes for
because I
wore black on the outside because black is how I feel on the inside.
And you're like, little Louie.
Yeah,
my sweet, sweet boy.
I'm sure it wasn't even The Cure. I'm sure I was listening to The Smiths.
Greetings, savory inferiors, and welcome to Vampire Insider, the unofficial podcast of the Anne Rice Immortal Universe. Each week, co-hosts Christina LaRusso, Joanne Palumbo, and myself, Mark Snedeker, recap and analyze episodes, delve into Anne Rice's library, and have in-depth discussions of other works about the supernatural. This week, we will be doing our triple deep dive into episode 6, Like Angels Put in Hell by God. I would like to welcome my co-hosts. Hello, Christina LaRusso. Hello, Joanne Palumbo.
Hello, Mark. Hello, Joanne.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good. Better than you. You were crashed out sleeping.
Joni slept through the first 10 minutes of the podcast, but
I must have dozed off after work. I was supposed to be on at 6. It's now 6:45 and we're just getting started thanks to me. So sorry, guys. Sorry.
No, well, it's okay.
At least I defended you. Christina was like, why don't we just record it without her? And I'm like, what? We can't record without Donnie.
I doubt it, Mark. Mark, I know you were probably like, you know what? That's it. Let's fire her. Just me and you, babe.
Yeah,
we
she's
can do
out.
It.
Block her on all the accounts.
I knew it.
No.
We would never do that.
Okay, so Mark and Joanne, I'm really excited to say that we have seen recently an uptick in listens, I'm assuming from new listeners finding us from...
It can't be old listeners because they're going back and listening to episode 1.
That's true. Unless they're really bored.
Yeah.
And lots of them are going back to listen to episode 1.
That was a pretty sweet episode,
you guys. But we'd like to welcome... I think it's probably people who are finding Interview with the Vampire from Max, where it's currently streaming until the end of October. I think it's going to be streaming on Max. So I'd like to just say welcome new listeners, and we hope that you enjoy the podcast, and please come and follow us on Twitter. If you are on Twitter, we are at vampire_insider. I am at Christina Gen X. Mark is at Mark Eats Peach. And we love to interact with the fandom community. So please don't hesitate to drop us a line if you have any thoughts or suggestions about something you'd like to hear our thoughts on at vampireinsider@gmail.com.
But don't get weird. So we are once again returning to the Vampire Insider Writers Room. So this week we are featuring a work by Fairy Whimsy entitled We Dared Eternity and Won. I do want to point out that they wrote this story as part of a series, so it's not really a standalone. The name of their series is The Forgotten Years. Fairy Whimsy wrote the first story solo and then had a co-author, C. Brown J.C., for the rest of their stories. So we encourage you, of course, to explore their entire library. But why don't I go ahead and give us the summary for We Dared Eternity and Won. This is written by the author. Louis watches Daniel before they first meet in Polynesian Mary's. For anyone else who is as impatient to see a potential beginning for what they call a reverse Claudia, a contrast to the beginning of Claudia's story and the 4 good years they had together before everything exploded. It is part of the Forgotten Years universe. So when we read fan fiction, we're starting to see, you know, certain styles emerge. Some of them are imagining situations that never happened in the canon, but are just fun for them to imagine. Some of them are sexy time explorations. Some of them are kind of, like this one, I believe, are kind of looking at the spaces in between, right? Because you have this story, and you know some shit went down in this period of time, but you're not necessarily going to get a play-by-play of every minute. And right now, we're really just kind of guessing as to what happened in the in that time before Louis meets Daniel. Of course, mm-hmm. we have some idea, at least in the canon, as to what happens after they, you know, Armand meets Daniel, etc. But it's a very interesting exploration of kind of in between those narrative spaces to kind of fill in some detail. And Christina has selected an excerpt to read, and we'll now turn that over to her silky, honeyed voice.
Well, before I start reading, I want to say that this segment that I'm going to share is from chapter one, but it is towards the end of chapter one. So there's sections within the chapter, and this is section seven. So just to give a little bit of context, what happens in the earlier sections of this chapter is Louis sees Daniel. He's drawn to Daniel, and he starts to follow Daniel around, both physically and also by reading his mind and learning about Daniel that way. So he's lurking outside of Daniel's work and the home he shares. And so he's learning about Daniel that way.
And is the Elton John song playing in the background the whole time?
No. Also of note here is Louis and Armand share a home. And so they are in the midst of their relationship as well. That's still ongoing. And Louis has some anxiety around that. He has some anxiety around...
Are you serious? Louis does? Shocking.
He doesn't really want Armand to know about Daniel.
Right.
And he's fearful that Armand might kill Daniel. We know, because we've read Devil's Minion, we know that Armand's probably going to have a very different feeling about Daniel.
Yes, he does feel a certain way.
He has.
And it's not really murderous.
No, no. So, all right. So
but that is a legit fear with Armand.
It is. It could be. All right. So that is where this scene now is situated. On the night of September 4th, 1973, Louis stood just behind the bay window on the second floor of Divisadero Street, which gave him a view of the whole street. Sometimes there were late-night walkers, and Louis would slit his eyes almost closed, watching them pass that intent way with which Armand always seemed to view the entire world. He knew it captivated mortals, that complete intensity, all of it entirely focused on them. That was what Louis needed to bring with him on the night he properly met Daniel. That was the way he would manage to hook the boy's attention. Just another couple more months of practice, Louis thought. Another couple of months, and he could be ready. What are you doing? Armand's voice, sudden and unexpected. Louis jumped, spun around, to find the same intense gaze pinning him now, almost the very bay window he'd stood before. He could hardly catch his breath to speak. Armand's head tilted just slightly to the side as he drank in Louis's thoughts and plans with as much care as though he was cradling a human neck. Louis, he said finally, I think it is time you and I go out together tonight. No, I, Louis started, fear starting in him before he'd properly had time to think. Not for himself, of course. I will not hurt your human pet. The pause before Armand spoke the last word indicated the difference in the way Armand would have kept a pet as compared to the way Louis was doing. Indeed, Louis needed no reminder of Dennis. Daniel was nothing like Dennis, the boy who had become a mere shadow of whatever human being before Louis came across him, before Armand had found and captivated him. Louis couldn't stand even the idea of Daniel continuing to live his life, but stifled. The light from his eyes dimmed as he began to see nothing more of the world than what Armand showed to him. How could he allow such a thing to pass, this vivacious boy who had so much life in him, who thrilled at every question to pass his mind? How could Louis face seeing that curiosity ever being snuffed out? Louis could never allow Daniel to become less than everything he already was and was destined to be. I will let you drive this thing, Armand murmured, in that tone of voice Louis had so recently attempted to mimic just this evening before Armand had returned home. I will not touch him myself, not unless you ask me to. Do you need me to promise it? No, Louis answered softly. A promise from Armand would not change the way the night would go from here. Louis could either believe his words or not. Armand would do whatever he wished, regardless of what he did or did not say. And he had decided this would be the way this night would go. There was nothing for Louis to do now but follow along. Louis eyed Armand. He wondered whether this was the moment when he should finally leave behind this parody of a shitty marriage. But hadn't the time for that passed from the minute Armand first knew about Louis's new interest? Louis could be set off, of course, but Armand's cold precision in action was something Louis would never leave another unknowing and defenseless to face alone. Even if they hadn't attracted him, lured him from his numbness as Daniel had done. Suddenly, Armand was standing directly before him, defying Louis to disappear into his own thoughts and away from him again. His brown hand cupped Louis's jaw. They stared to each other eye to eye. "Do you not think it thrills me to see you return again to the land of the living?" he murmured, close enough to Louis that he could feel the older immortal's breath against his lips. It was closer than he and Armand had been to one another for months, Louis realized. Blood sharing had been a thing that had long since lapsed between them due to Louis's lack of interest. Even the full extent of Armand's passion, it seemed, could not withstand Louis's gentle apathy. And so Louis shuddered to feel him so close, to remember the very intimacy of what that blood sharing between them had once been like. If Louis had been a liar, he would have told himself that it was because having Armand this close to him revolted Louis. But the truth was, Armand had never, ever revolted him. Terrified him, captivated him, held him entirely in his thrall as he held so many of those around him. Others Armand went to in order to find the spark of interest he'd been unable to wrest from Louis for years now. But no, Louis had never been revolted by Armand. It would have been simpler in so many ways if he had. A thought struck Louis, paralyzing and horrifying Louis at once with the reality of it. If Armand was standing there, how would Daniel ever know to even look at Louis? How could Louis ever compete with Armand? He hadn't even thought of that before. Armand brushed his lips against Louis's, and Louis felt an echoing brush of Armand's mind against his own. "I would not, not for anything, take from you what has brought you back into this world. Not again." It was the nearest thing Louis had ever heard from Armand to an apology for what had passed between them. In the first decade, after Claudia, Armand had impressed upon Louis that it was only because he loved him so devoutly and could not possibly share him that he had done as he'd done. It had been the old rules he had been obeying, but how could he ever have gone against the rules of his own heart? Louis had never known what to say in the face of such impassioned speeches. Eventually, it had seemed simpler if he said nothing at all. He could not excuse nor absolve Armand from any of it. That was Armand's work to do, or not, as had so routinely been in evidence. So this was new, an acknowledgement that Armand knew his actions had adversely affected Louis, one that had not been followed up immediately by how Louis should understand why. No wonder Armand had spoken the words into Louis's mind when he was so close to him now that they could not even look each other in the eye. This was an intimacy of a different sort. Louis gasped with it, and Armand took advantage of the opening of Louis's mouth to explore it with his own, tongue entering the wet space of Louis's mouth almost as soon as it was open. There was a contrasting temperature between them. Armand had recently fed. Louis could both taste and feel that. When was the last time Louis had done the same? Not so long as he was beginning to feel weak, or Armand to hound him. And so Louis moaned, letting go of the wondering, even as he was utterly diverted by the potential of this new side of Armand. Could Armand actually change himself in such a way? Or was it merely something Louis saw because he so ardently wished to? Perhaps this time Armand was telling the truth. Perhaps he would allow Louis to be the one between them to lead where it came to Daniel. Perhaps Armand would be the one to simply fade into the background. "All you need to do with him is be yourself," Armand murmured, ending their kiss for the moment, just nipping lightly, teasingly at his lips, not hard enough to break the delicate skin, maybe just to remind him that he could. "No one else, certainly not me, just your completely alluring, captivating self." Louis didn't know if he believed him. Still, he'd hardly had enough practice to be anything else. Himself was what it would have to be, despite all, if Armand was determined this meeting should be tonight. "I am," Armand answered shortly. "Very well, then." Louis supposed there could not be two blood drinkers in the world walking around acting exactly like Armand. Imagine the chaos of it. Armand offered the huff of a low chuckle at that, still lingering on the edges of Louis's mind, even if he did not see fit to speak. And the positive thing to come out of this, Louis thought, slowly rallying to the idea of it being tonight, would be that Louis could meet him, could meet Daniel Malloy on his own terms, if not his own timing. Because if Louis was wrong to trust Armand, one of two things would happen tonight. Either Armand would take Daniel to be his newest pet, or he would kill the boy outright. Either way, Louis would lose him forever. The thought had Louis separating himself slightly from Armand, pressing both hands lightly against the older immortal's chest. It was a good thing Armand had not bitten either one of their tongues as yet. Louis did not think he would have had the strength to pull away had either of them begun to taste the other, not after so long. Sternly, Louis told himself to push Armand back yet further, lest he consider the thoughts in Louis's mind an invitation. He could not close his mind to Armand as he could his mouth. Trust in me. Armand was leaning far enough back from Louis now that they could look into each other's eyes, even as he retreated back to speaking into his mind. But their eyes didn't shift from each other. Armand's topaz to Louis's emerald. I want to. The words weren't enough on their own to state just how much Louis wished he could, so he kept them in the front of his mind, knowing Armand would take the yearning along with the sentiment. You cannot betray me with this. I cannot bear it. A pause, almost as though Armand was considering it, considering more possibilities than the particular outcome Louis lay before him. And then Armand extended his hand out between them. And Louis. Well, what could Louis do but take it? Polynesian Marys, Louis murmured, his mouth hardly moving, the words bearing hardly any volume when Louis first began to speak them. 154 McAllister Street, that's where he'll be. I know, beloved, Armand answered, because of course he did. Armand always knew everything, even before it happened. Perhaps he, too, already knew Daniel's mind. Perhaps he was listening into the boy's every thought, even now. Do not worry, tonight I will take care of it all.
Narrator, he definitely betrays him.
He definitely betrays him. But okay, so that's it. And it's a lengthy section that I read. And I thought that section really, it spoke to me.
Yeah, because you're showing that the tension and the complexity of Louis's relationship with Armand, his kind of yearning for this new shiny object in Daniel, and his very, very, very valid concerns that Armand's going to just take him for himself, which he super does.
In the
immortal universe.
In the canon, he does. But I just found this whole concept to give us a little glimpse into what maybe makes Louis decide to do this thing, which is tell his story to immortal. Why does he do this? What drives him to do this? And I think that is a valid take on this. That could be one of the things. He just saw him and he's attracted to him, whatever the attraction means. And in a way that he hadn't felt, right? Armand makes the point of saying, you're more connected. He's brought you back into life.
You were mopey. Now you're slightly less mopey.
Now you're excited. You're excited about something.
Let's just say slightly less mopey.
I thought it was a really interesting take on the way that Louis stumbles upon Daniel. I mean, long story short, boy sees boy, worried about how the murder goblin at home is going to feel when he finds out about boy. And he had every right to be nervous about it, as we know. I mean, maybe it'll end up differently in this story than it does in the actual original story. But I really liked having that kind of front seat view into Louis's mind as he's watching Daniel, getting to know him, knowing his habits. There's a section where he talks about Daniel hooking up with one of his roommates, and he kind of, learned if Daniel was into that by all that whole situation. And then, when the time comes where he's finally built up his nerve to kind of approach him, in comes Armand to, I think Louis is afraid he's going to cock block him because he does stay in there. How's anyone going to look at me with Armand standing next to me? So he already feels inferior to him. So he's kind of, resound to the fact that now, okay, I'm not doing this alone. I've got my murder goblin sidekick with me. And this just might not go the way that I wanted it to or how I envisioned it. So it was really cool kind of perspective into that thought process of Louis of when he first stumbles upon Daniel, and you kind of get a taste of what Armand is thinking, but not really. So it'll be fun to read the next few chapters to find out exactly what happens once they do So I think it'll be very exciting to see how this all plays out in this particular universe. You know, it's a will he, won't he? Will Armand fuck it up for Louis, or will he be like the best wingman of all time?
Do you know where the smart money is on that?
Yeah.
For me, Armand, I mean, I know I joke about him being a murder goblin and all that, but he certainly doesn't lack passion, but at certain times he's almost insectoid, you know, looking at humans dispassionately, looking at other vampires even dispassionately, and just kind of looking at them like they're a butterfly pinned on a board, right? And he knows everything, even stuff people don't want him to know. And that was a very interesting point there. Like, Armand knows everything. That's got to be super annoying.
You know,
it's kind of like being around Christina all the time.
No, you know what's interesting about what you're saying about Armand there is that I know which books you've read. I know that you haven't read The Vampire Armand yet.
Sure, just out me.
No, and that's okay because we'll get there in our reading. But Armand in The Vampire Armand seems a little bit, well, because you meet him when he's a human.
Yeah.
So you go through, you learn more about him, and he is a spectacular human character. But you're quite right that by the time we meet him in Interview with the Vampire, he very much is detached from
humanity.
Well, he's very much detached from present day. Yeah. What the right. present day is, yeah, in Interview with the Vampire, right? So he's got, that's why he likes Louis.
Yeah.
Initially,
and
right?
KitchenAid products.
He likes Louis because Louis can connect him with modern day. It's the same thing in Devil's Minion chapter. He likes Daniel because Daniel can help him connect. It's sort of like his tether is stretching because he's an older vampire.
Yeah.
So this tether to humanity for him has stretched far, far, far away. And we've talked about this too with immortality, where they become disconnected from an immortal, as you would think, right?
Yeah.
Might become disconnected from the time that is so far outside of their own generation. But you get, I mean, as you age as a human being, there's a nostalgia that you start to feel for the time of your youth, and things around you start to change, and you can adapt to those changes, and hopefully we do, right? And we learn and we grow as people. But there is an attachment to some of the things that make you, that are familiar to you, that feel really familiar. Certain kinds of music and clothing and things like that. And a lot of times you'll see people who stick with their hairstyles from, you know, we see plenty of people who stick with their hairstyles from the 80s, which may be...
Interesting choice.
Let's rethink that because it's not good for your hair. So you're right. I think that's there is that capturing of Armand as this sort of, like, you know, yeah. Mark keeps tilting his head.
I know it doesn't really translate into the podcast,
but it's true.
It's working on Christina,
it's
though.
Just
let me tell you.
Kind of like he's inquisitive. Armand is inquisitive about things and gets fixated on things and wants to understand things. But I think he finds it increasingly difficult as time moves further away from when he was a human.
So. Right. So we're going to strongly recommend that our listeners explore this universe that Fairy Whimsy has created along with their partner. I think that this, you know, I feel like I didn't read enough of this story.
Yeah.
Like I need to go and
you have to
plunge into
I'm
it a bit
I'm interested in more of it because I want to know what those, you know, you were making that comment before about how it fills the spaces that we haven't really seen, that Anne Rice didn't feel. The spaces that exist, the universe is there. There's just nothing. She hasn't filled those spaces.
And it reminds it's not
me
possible.
It reminds me a lot of what people do with Star Wars now.
Yeah, sure.
Where there are spaces in Star Wars that people are filling with really compelling stories.
Like, you know, Luke Skywalker in grade school. Let's explore that, right? Was he levitating his other students or whatever?
You know. I mean, I think probably.
Was he good at art? I don't know. We don't know.
We don't know because we don't know. But you know what I'm saying, right?
I do know what you're saying.
So I think that's what these kinds of authors do. And it's valuable to me because, of course, you want to know. You want to know everything. If you are into a universe, a fictional universe, then you want to know what the hell was going on between X and Z.
And I think that's because ultimately the strongest fans of the Immortal Universe, and really of any universe or story, et cetera, is their consumers. They want more media. They want mm-hmm. more content.
Yep.
And this allows the fanfic, which, by the way, we celebrate 100%. It allows not only the creators, but the people who read their stories to explore those unfilled spaces. And I think this is doing an excellent job of, even though this is the chapter one was just a very tiny period in time, right? Wasn't sweeping across generations or anything. It was a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of narrative that can be tucked into that. And that's what consumers of the Immortal Universe want. They want more of that content.
And it's really limitless, right? I mean, there's no limit to what a fan can write. It really opens up the door to just about anything that their imagination can come up with. And I've never read fanfic before, and I've really enjoyed it in these scenarios, especially because it is, you know, and sometimes it's scratching an itch for us that, you know, what happened with Daniel and Armand and Louis and in kind of like post the last episode of the show. But also it gives us this fantasy to kind of play around with things that we'd never thought of before.
Okay. Well, I would like to thank Fairy Whimsy for their fantastic submission to the Vampire Insider Writers Room. Thank you very much for sharing your work with us. And we will be putting the link to the story in our episode notes, and we'll be sharing it on our Twitter feed. So please go and take a look at it. If you're not looking at what the fan fiction
support these artists.
We ought to be looking in this fan fiction.
Buy them a car.
This is a really creative. These are content creators who are actually putting a lot of effort and
absolutely
time into what they're doing.
And they're fantastic writers too. This is they're not subpar writers. Let's put it that way. A lot of these people are excellent writers. It's not just the content, it's the writing style. They're very talented individuals, and they deserve to have their work recognized.
All right. So we're going to do a deep dive into episode 6. Let's do what we always do, which is we go around and we do a little hot take. Now we've watched it again. We've had some time in between when we first watched it. Let's do hot takes. Joe, what's your hot take?
First of all, my first thing I want to say is I think they should rename the episode Tickets, Please. Because if there is nothing else in that episode that is wonderful, it is that hippity hop that our beloved Sam Reed does that just is, I want to bite his face when he has his little conductor's head on his hand and he says, tickets, please. I live for that moment every time I watch this episode. But anyway, this was a really pivotal episode in that it showed us post Louis and Claudia's life after the big brawl between him and Lestat happened, and Claudia's nurturing of Louis and, you know, bringing him back to health over the years and kind of staving off the attempts from Lestat to woo Louis back. She did the best that she could for as long as she could. And we know, obviously, eventually he gets him with that come to me song. And ultimately they invite him back in the house. Bullshit and chaos ensues. Claudia tries to leave. Lestat goes back, snatches her, and says, you're not going anywhere, darling. And that was when the plot to kill Lestat really was born, you know, once she came back. It's just a really good episode, and it's so important to move the story along. So it's just so good. What did you guys think?
Probably three major things for me. First is Sam's Brooklyn accent is almost as good as my Australian accent. So kudos to you, Sam. Good job. Vampires are very good, apparently, at multitasking. So apparently you can be doing it with your boyfriend, but also having a conversation with your daughter at the same time. Or you could be kicking someone's ass at chess and be plotting their murder with someone else telepathically at the same time. So that, to me, is very impressive. Louis on the one hand, where he's sexing and chatting, and then certainly Claudia on the other, where she is executing a very perfect Polish gambit, I think is what it's called.
Polish immortal.
Is that what it's called? The Polish immortal? Yeah, that's right. Very good. And also plotting Lestat's murder. So very good multitasking there. The last thing is when we get, I was really struck by when we got to young Daniel. He has that certain kind of like late 60s, early 70s naivete where it's like, I'm only going to interview real people, man. You know, not like those stuffed shirt squares, you know, that everybody else interviews. I'm not interviewing scientists or business people, man. I'm talking to people in the streets, like real people. And that just kind of cracked me up that, you know, he has, that was a very real approach to things back then where, you know, it was very anti-establishment and rebellious. And clearly Daniel is all in on that. Mm-hmm. And plus he's doing drugs.
Yet he has the drinking habits of a 1970s housewife with that grasshopper.
That grasshopper.
I know. I was like,
the hell?
You're getting a grasshopper? I mean, dude, I mean, that's fine. I mean,
it's
a delicious beverage, but that's just that's a fucked up drink.
But what are you doing? I mean, it's not really going to get you drunk.
Yeah. I mean, you're just,
it's creme de menthe.
Yeah. You might as well.
What are you?
I mean, you know, you're in a vampire movie for fuck's sake, put some absinthe in it or something.
Have some whiskey, man.
Yeah. Tequila, something.
That actor, by the way, is called Luke Brandon Field. And I don't even know how they could have gotten a better match.
He's excellent.
You have to say that the casting of this show.
That might be the biggest genius of this show.
My God, like whoever the casting director is, we need to really actually find that out and do an entire episode of this person's brilliance because it is so fantastic. Every episode is a great episode, but I never realized how really powerful this episode was because I think I was still hung over from episode 5 when I watched this because it's like a week, right? Yeah. Obviously between when we see
by my calculations,
episode 5 to
7 days.
Episode 6. And episode 5 was so shocking when it came out and it really, really floored me. And so when we came to episode 6, I think I was still really grappling with episode 5.
Yeah.
Episode 6 is such a powerful episode. That scene with Sam Reed sitting, being questioned by and sort of interrogated and being forced to make concessions in order to be left back in the house with Claudia and Louis on one side and him on the other. And he's just sitting there and the slow zoom in shot on him as he's telling his backstory, his sob story, as Claudia calls it, how these guys did not get put up for some Emmy nomination.
I blame AMC. You're just not marketing your show correctly. I mean, they have redeemed themselves somewhat by this move to put it on Max, which I think was genius.
Yeah.
Because, you give up some streams on your own for a while, but you generate massive amounts of interest that you didn't have before.
That's right.
I was really struck during that scene about how dumb this list was.
Which list?
The list of rules. Well, it's a dumb list.
Okay. Well, let's get to it. Let's get to it now that we've had our hot take. Let's jump into talking about details in the episode that really struck us and how we are thinking about trauma, because obviously that scene where they give the list, there's a lot of Lestat's trauma there too.
Absolutely. So it's so artificial. Right. You think you have this complicated relationship between three people who have been together for what now? 30 years, something like that, 25 years, whatever it is. So you to think that you can write some shit down on a piece of paper and get him to promise to it is going to change the nature of the relationship. And Lestat, I think, even says something about it. It's like, oh, you're just going to, by proclamation, you change, our relationships. Right. You can't say, OK, now I'm an equal. When you never have been. You can demand behaviors, but you can't just assume that you can change the nature of a relationship simply by proclaiming it. You know, they're making him promise all these things, knowing who Lestat is, and, no more lies. And then everybody's lying. Mm-hmm. including Claudia, mm-hmm. right? She's lying because she's plotting his murder, right? You know, no more secrets. Well, except for, you know, we're going to be having telepathic conversations without Lestat, and Lestat still has his side piece and everything. So it's just a completely ineffective list. I understand, you know, the motivation to try to set new rules and stuff, but, you know, it was just pretty laughable to me that anybody thought that was going to work in any way.
Again, and I went back and I listened to us talk about this episode.
I did too, Christina, after you said you did.
One of the things that I mentioned in that episode, our episode, was that I've been looking at this through kind of a wrong lens. And I think now I've had a whole bunch of time to recalibrate. And before I was looking at it as Interview with a Vampire, the sort of existential crisis of a vampire. What does it mean to be a vampire? What does it mean to live like life as a vampire? Because that's what that book is about. But this is about toxic relationships.
Yep.
That's what this series is really about. And so looking at it from through that lens, you absolutely have to see how people, for instance, in I don't know if either of you are familiar with forums where people have are struggling with infidelity in their relationships.
I am, only because you've told me about it.
Because I've told you about it. But there are forums where people go and they get advice from others who are like support groups. And when I tell you that scene and this whole thing of him begging to come back and, you know, all of the rest, that is 100% stuff that happens in real life.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Where you try and you make this list and you say, well, there's going to be complete transparency and I'm going to have the passwords to all of your emails and we're going to have a Facebook,
but it's a joint Facebook
and you are not allowed to have your own social media. And you
might as well throw yourself off the roof at that point.
And first sign that it's over, joint social media.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is a true thing that happens, those impossible lists. And
yeah,
here's the one thing that Lestat doesn't really do. He wants Louis back, or you guys can tell me if you think you agree with me. He wants Louis back, but do you feel like he shows a lot of remorse?
Oh no, he's Lestat.
He's full of shit.
Yeah, he has barely sort of hinted at apologies, right? Mm-hmm. And Louis's like, you know, the one thing he did that worked to a certain extent, he still fucked up probably on purpose by having his side piece sing on it.
Well, he did on purpose. He 100% did that on purpose, because he knew that the thing he was trying, all the things that he thought would get Louis, getting
to get him
a book
fired
and all
up.
Of this. And the thing that motivated Louis was jealousy.
Yeah.
And that's what worked. And that's what made Louis swim the river to get to him.
What in the hell, Louis?
Am I the only one that pictures Louis with like the record?
Yeah,
in his
where
mouth
is he? Where is the record?
Is he sprinting across the water like some kind of track star Jesus?
I mean, what the hell? Like, where is that record when you're swimming, man? But yes. So.
Do you think maybe he was on his back like an otter, clutching the record to his chest and just like backpedaling?
No, he had it in his mouth and was doggy paddling
really fast.
I just
that was a little silly. Yeah,
yeah. But I mean,
swam the Mississippi for me. Okay, yeah. He's like, well, yeah, I guess he did, but that's a little whack.
You're soaking wet, Louis, and you know. So, but it is such a a very triggering thing for Lestat to have done. So he's still being abusive.
Of course. That lists don't change who the people are. Yes, you can, you know, moving to a new phase of your relationship and you can, you know, be forgiven and reform somewhat, but you can't hand somebody a 14 line list and expect that that's going to do it.
What struck me about that, the scene where Louis swims the river and goes to Lestat, is that
the blanket?
Well, the blanket. Yes, we definitely mentioned that in the last episode too, Joanne.
That was my favorite character of the whole episode. That blanket, my lord, it was doing the Lord's work. That blanket.
Oh my God!
He had a lot of faith in that blanket.
So, no. But what struck me about that was that Louis, this is a part of Louis's trauma.
Oh, for sure.
Right. Louis's been through this terrible, terrible trauma with Lestat. There was trauma prior to that. Obviously, Paul's death.
Yes.
And we'll go into sort of each of the characters and where we think sort of their trauma sits. But Louis being re-traumatized in this situation when Lestat triggers him intentionally. That's an intentional trigger. And when there's been infidelity in a relationship, take away the abuse side of it. Take away the physical abuse that Lestat was inflicted on Louis. There was infidelity. And so that trauma, it's very easy to trigger that with little, just little things that you do. When you do something like, well, your lover is now singing a song that you wrote for your boyfriend that you want, or your husband that you want to get back. What in the hell? But there's a line later in the episode where Louis says Lestat and Claudia were the same. They looked for people's weaknesses. So he knows that that's going to hurt him. He knows that's a weakness.
Well, and it worked.
And it did.
To Lestat's credit, it worked. After years of, you know, cars and books and whatever crap. I mean, I think it was Louis or Claudia. One of them said, as they, you know, in narration, we burned more gifts than bodies during that period. So all of the stuff that, you know, Lestat bestowed upon Louis failed except for this. So he knew what he was doing, and he's a genius.
So I have a question for you two ladies. We've all made mistakes in relationships. Everybody has. But have you ever made a mistake that required a Rolls Royce Phantom 2 in order to recover from it?
I've never made a mistake of that size, but I've had mistakes of that size made to me. So I feel like I should have like a fleet of Rolls Royce Phantoms. Yeah, I should have a fleet at this point in my life.
All right, so let's talk about trauma.
Yeah.
In each of the main characters. So that's all four of them. Let's talk about Louis, Claudia, Lestat, and Daniel. So let's start out with? Joe, you pick who we want to start out with and talk about their trauma.
My favorite little girl, Claudia.
Claudia. Okay.
So Claudia's trauma really began long before she encountered Louis and Lestat. She was living in a boarding house, being raised by her aunt. I know she didn't have a traditional home with a mother and a father. She was living in this boarding house. There were some points in the story where she talked about abuse from men within the boarding house. So her life, her human life, was less than desirable. And then in comes Louis, who rips her from this burning building, a fire that his actions of, you know, killing somebody ultimately caused. So his guilt was consuming him, pulls her out. And here comes her real trauma. Like, this girl thought her human life was bad. Now it's like she leveled up, realizing that she's a murderer. You know, in order to survive, she has to drink human blood. She loves it. She becomes a pretty prolific killer. There's the trauma of the realization that she's always going to be a little girl. Although if she made it to 2023 or, you know, in mid-20s, she would be okay, because 12-year-olds look like they're 30, but that's a whole other story. She could have passed for a full-blown adult nowadays. But anyway, so she experiences that trauma of being trapped in this little girl's body. So she's perpetually a little innocent child, when in reality, inside, she's a grown ass woman who has to live as this little doll every day of her life. And there's no way any of us could ever fathom that type of trauma. There's nobody living on this earth who's, you know, stuck in this little girl body, so to speak, for all of eternity. That was something that's very individual to Claudia, but we can only imagine how awful that must be. She states it, I think it was at the end of episode 5, that she'll never be a mom. She'll never raise children. She'll never be a wife and take care of a home. And that really, she's at that point of her life where she was realizing all of that. And that re-traumatizes her all over again, because it's not just the physical, her physical limits. It's also those limits that she'll never give birth. She'll never have those moments. She does nurture Louis. All the things that she said she couldn't be, she really became to Louis in this episode. She was a mother. She was a spouse. She was a caregiver. She was, you know, feeding him. She brought him back to to life. She was his guardian. And all of that, when he goes back to Lestat, really just, I think, traumatizes her all over again. I think she felt so betrayed, and she knew, because she's not stupid, she knew this wasn't going to last. I think the moment he walked back into their lives was when she really started plotting his demise. She's been through it, and it's no surprise that all of those things led her to that moment where she hatches this great plan to off Lestat.
We're going to kill Lestat. Yeah, so all of those things are constantly working on Claudia. It's hard to say sometimes which is the bigger trauma. In the book, I think you could argue that the biggest trauma was being frozen in time as a young child. That is somewhat mitigated now by the fact that she's aged up. It's still an issue, but it really seems at this point that her main trauma is trying to figure out, or not being satisfied with, where she fits in these relationships, right? She doesn't she feels like Lestat just created her to be a replacement for Louis's sister, or, you know, to salve Louis's guilt, etc. She's jealous of their relationship. She's jealous she doesn't have a similar relationship that she can rely on. She cares, or at least pretends to care, for Louis as a more or less a parent figure. He's not all in on that because he's involved with Lestat, right? So I think that's her major source of trauma. Obviously, being assaulted by Bruce was a huge, huge, had a huge impact on her. But I think over the course of her, you know, fairly short life at this point, it's really that not fitting into and having someone to call her own. She can't call Louis her own, certainly can't call Lestat her own. The first boyfriend she had, she killed, you know, and we'll find out later, of course, that she wants her own companion. She wants her own Claudia exclusive relationship, and she doesn't have it.
I agree with both of you. I'm going to get a little literary here. I think that the showrunners, the writers, gave us a little bit of a hint into what's going on with Claudia. As she and Louis are walking, she says to him that she's reading Emily Dickinson. And she references two poems. One is, I felt a funeral in my brain, and the other one is, a coffin is a small domain.
Right.
And she's talking to Louis about, is Emily Dickinson a vampire? Right. So there's that. But Emily Dickinson, in the later part of her life, became essentially a shut-in.
Yeah.
And when she did go out, she was, you know, kind of seen as this eccentric and always wearing white. Right. But so I started thinking about Claudia in those terms. And I think that you're both right. Like, she feels confined. She doesn't know where she fits into the relationship. She was forced into this relationship. Right. She had no choice in the matter. She was taken, and
she can't escape.
She can't escape.
She was an innocent lamb.
She was an innocent lamb. But my point here is that she's reading Emily Dickinson, shut in, and then she's reading things like, a coffin is a small domain. Now, think about what that means for her, right? That's it. A coffin is a small domain. And if you think about, again, the claustrophobia of that house, right? They know that they're under suspicion. We keep hearing again and again in this episode how they're being watched by their neighbors. I think a huge part of her trauma is being shut in.
Yeah.
When she wants to go. She
wants to go out,
she
explore.
She wants to go out and explore. And when she did, the one time she did try to do that, more trauma. She was sexually assaulted. So I think, for me, her trauma is rooted in being stuck.
Trapped.
In this situation when she has a brilliant and bright mind and wants to get out. And Louis says, of anybody on that train, her with her, you know, her bright mind and all of the wonderful things that Claudia is, she's the one that deserved a window with a big panorama.
Yeah.
And she was stuck, you know, the people of color would have to ride in the back. A vampire would have to be hidden. You know, she can't see anything. And then here comes Lestat, who, again, Lestat and Claudie are alike. They look for each other. They look for people's weaknesses. The first thing he does is say, well, not the very first thing, but one of the things that he says in that moment in the train car is, you know, he's thinking about you all the time.
Yeah.
He reminds her he's still out there. So for me, yeah, I think her trauma is rooted in all of the things that we said, but for me, it's this feeling of being trapped. And baby Claudia, when she was a 5-year-old, her body was really the thing that was trapping her. Claudia, this Claudia, a little bit older, you know, she can work around that. It's just that she can't leave this suffocating, right, horrible, small domain, which is this coffin of a house that she's stuck in, this coffin of a relationship that she's stuck in. Out of this trauma, then, Claudia becomes very internal. Her plotting, her scheming, it's a very internal thing. She's very capable of pushing down impulses and being very focused on putting her scheme into action, right? Yeah. Like, and she is multiple steps ahead of everybody. She's got, Louis doesn't have any clue what's going. Louis's just like, oh, I love Lestat. I can't stop falling in love with Lestat. Right. And Lestat is obviously just, he doesn't think anybody can outsmart him. He's not. It's hubris. Hubris. Hubris is Lestat's downfall. Yeah. Okay. So let's do, who's next? Do you want to do Lestat?
Lestat clearly has some mommy issues. We know from the books, at least. We don't really know it from the show yet, but he did not have a warm and caring upbringing. Let's just say that. His trauma in the show, though, seems to be mostly centered around loneliness. He mentions it many times, how he can't stand to be abandoned. He doesn't want to be lonely. You know, he's looking for someone to spend this dark eternity with. He is hurt by what he perceives as not being loved back in the way he wants. And that is his, at least, trauma in the show up until the point where they murder him, in that, in which case that probably supplants the earlier trauma as a bigger trauma.
Or it just adds to his trauma.
It's like, oh, you abandoned me and you murderized me. Mm-hmm. That's not cool. So really, for him, it's being lonely. And even though he does appear to be very capable of entertaining himself and going off on his own, and he wants to do his own thing, but he also wants to have someone there for him when he needs or wants them. The fact that Louis is ambivalent about the lifestyle and that they're struggling in their relationship because, of course, Louis, you know, for some period of time cares about his human family and then transfers that more to Claudia. And, you know, Lestat, he's traumatized by not getting everything he wants. Is it justified trauma? Probably not. He definitely does kind of carry that wound wherever he goes, where he just doesn't want to be abandoned. And he wants to be the center of someone's universe.
It can also be boiled down to control issues with Lestat that stems from his trauma. You know, his origin story about being locked in the tower with bodies that looked like him, the same eyes, the same hair, the same physique, you know, and then having his maker kind of just throw himself in a fire and be done with him definitely caused his abandonment issues. But he approaches those issues by being uber controlling. You know, he wants everything on his terms, like you said, Mark. He wants his lover to love him the way that he wants to. And it's an unrealistic expectation. And he's his own worst enemy because, with the exception, you know, so far, just looking at it through the lens of the show, he pushes away the people that truly love him, with the exception of Antoinette, who's kind of like, you know, she kind of really simps for him.
He did chop her finger off. To be fair, he does push her away when Louis shows up, right? Mm-hmm. And she just goes outside and cries and smokes.
Right. But also he says he kills her. He doesn't kill her. You know what I mean? He wants to do things on his term. He wants to be done with Antoinette when he wants to be done with Antoinette, not when Louis or Claudia dare to tell him he's done with Antoinette. So the way he handles his trauma is just the worst way he can, which is trying to control everything around him. And you would think at his age, at his advanced vampiric age, he would know by now that that's not the way to do it. And part of me feels bad for him because of that. But also I know that he's just inherently a bad dude and he had no control in his human life and his upbringing. So that trauma has really forced him into controlling everybody and making his worst fear of abandonment come true. So he creates his own trauma in that regard. He's perpetuating that cycle of abandonment over and over in relationships because he's a dick at the end of the day. While I feel for Claudia's trauma in her life, and I do feel for Lestat in a way, he also really needs to learn like to grow up and, you know, be better in a relationship.
I would say that you say he has mommy issues and that's accurate. I think that's true. I think he's also got, you know, obviously some real issues with his father. That's who we hear the most about, yeah. Right? You know, in the episode one, we've heard about his father. Here he's talking about just this crappy thing that happened to him with his vampire father, where he creates Lestat and then he just takes off and jumps into the fire dancing away.
Very crazy way of taking yourself out.
That it's just weird. But the one thing that resonates for me very much in this, he says, I didn't want this. This isn't what I want. When, you know, when he says about becoming a vampire, being made a vampire, I didn't want this. And, you know, there's a comparison that can be made, a parallel that can be drawn with sexual assault, right? Like there's no consent. We've talked about this previously on podcasts.
Being bitten, yes.
Being turned without your consent. And in the book, Lestat takes great pains to make sure that Louis knows, well, you're giving me your consent. I'm giving you the opportunity to do this. I'm not just forcing you. But, you know, then of course you can say, well, did he or didn't he? So I think that Lestat has a lot of, yes, he wants control over things because he's had so much, as Joe is pointing out, so many things that have happened to him in the past where he doesn't have control. And then he works that out in very, very, very negative and bad ways. You know, just because you didn't have control in the past doesn't mean that you get to beat someone to death. Just because you didn't have control of your life in the past doesn't mean that with Antoinette, that situation, you know, I come here to not to have questions. I come here to laugh. And you know, she, of course, immediately buckles under and tries to become
not a strong character.
No, Antoinette. No. So it's just very he's an unattractive character that way. Right. Like, but I think that there are many people who can look at his backstory and say, God, you know, it's a tough backstory.
Now, he's not completely unsympathetic as a character.
No, he's not unsympathetic, but you brought this up. Just because they're a bad person doesn't mean that bad things didn't also happen to
Correct.
Them. So you brought that up in the previous episode.
I stand by that, Christina.
Yeah, I think it was.
I think that was a wise. It was a sage thing to say.
Mark, I hate to say it, but yeah, that might be one of the wisest things you've said since I've known you.
Okay, so let's talk about Louis and his trauma.
Louis,
which is very complex. Louis's trauma.
He seems fine to me.
Obviously, the part of Louis's trauma is Paul. Losing Paul the way that he did, that's of course what kind of put him in the vulnerable position to end up with Lestat, as a vampire. But I think for Louis also, there's some other stuff. First of all, his struggles with his sexuality. I don't know if that's trauma.
Let me take a crack at that real quick. I think that there's a good argument to be made that having to deny that part of you is very traumatic.
Right.
Certainly.
It's not the being gay.
No, it's not. It's the having to hide it.
Having to hide it that is traumatic. And especially then add to that the situation that he's in because of race.
Correct.
In that time period. And we've seen the microaggressions that he's had to deal with. We've seen the macro, you know, the aggressions that he's had to deal with. He's in a relationship with a man who doesn't seem to understand the stuff that he has to deal with.
Right.
You know, he's not with a partner who's super supportive about it. And
in fact, he's with a partner who thinks he solved that problem for him.
For him, right? And I mentioned that before. Lestat came in like a white savior in that first episode where he's like, let me take you away from all of this. I can give you this dark gift. It's going to make everything better for you. Well, it didn't make everything better for him, Lestat. He was still facing racism and your insensitivity about the things that he was facing just
compounds it.
He's got this relationship with Claudia. He knows, I think, that he is holding her back and he doesn't want to do that, but he also doesn't want to let her go. And I think that there's some guilt around how he's made her and how she's even here in the first place. And then that she can't leave and she's stuck in this rut and that he's holding her back. And I think that obviously the trauma that he had, huge trauma from the violent fight that he had with Lestat, that's horrible. That adds to his mix of trauma. Well, let me say this. Of the three that we've talked about, Louis, Claudia, and Lestat, Louis is the one who it does seem to try and figure out some stuff about himself. Remember, he's reading that self-help book.
Yes, marriage.
Trying to figure out what's going on in this relationship. Or why did it happen the way that it happened? And what, you know, maybe what could he have done better? What could Lestat certainly have done better? Like what, he's the one that's kind of trying to dig in, but also he just kind of gets into that rut and just, and stays there.
He just wallows in it.
It's really hard for him to break free from it. He's got tons of it. It's not, this isn't victim blaming, but there is this thing that he just kind of sinks into it. And Lestat ignores it, and Claudia is trying to fix it. Claudia is trying to be like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to get out. And so of the three of them, I think Louis, even though he's reading some of that self-help stuff, I'm not sure how much of that is being applied and sinking in.
Louis, it appears at least, and maybe this is an overly simplified thought, but he appears to have the deepest and most unshakable trauma because he's constantly consumed by it. Claudia has trauma, but she also is attempting to do something about it. I have trauma. All right, so here's how I'm going to solve it. Step one, kill Lestat.
Now I'm going to add Step a murder two, to my trauma.
You know, take a gap year in Europe. Right. Mm-hmm. So she's got plans. Louis is really just kind of reactionary, right? He doesn't have a plan. He knows that he's going to go back to Lestat and he knows that Lestat is going to be just as big a dick as he was before. Mm-hmm. He even says like, that's just Lestat. That's how he is. You know, that's why he didn't even confront him over the fact that he lied about Antoinette. He's just going to wallow in his misery.
Why does he do that?
And he allows himself to be kind of dragged around by it. That's just who he is as a character. Sometimes I do go, like, what is so attractive about Louis that Lestat and Armand and all these other people are just like, just obsessed.
Have you seen him?
Is it just that he's good looking? I don't think so. Maybe people are attracted to the wounded bird.
It's a project.
You know, project type thing. I know that some people do that, right? They're like, I can help this person. I can be useful to this person. I don't think that's Lestat's goal.
No, Lestat would say he wants a partner in the, you know, in this life.
What he really wants is a mirror, but
what he really wants is a mirror, somebody that's going to somebody that is infinitely obedient. Yeah. Yes, infinitely obedient.
But also interesting, right?
But okay, so
like put up a fight but not too much of a fight,
right?
You know what I'm saying?
And you know, and Jacob was very beautifully cast for this because in the book all you hear about Louis is how he is, and this is true in the book too. Everyone is drawn to Louis and his gorgeous good looks, right? And sort of his enigmatic way, I guess, about him. I guess maybe it's because he does stay more tethered to his humanity.
Yeah. And maybe that makes him very attractive to the vampires. Maybe that makes him
attractive to vampires.
Yeah.
You know, again, as time goes on, their tether stretches more and more to their humanity until they become statues.
Yeah.
You know?
I think Louis was a stronger person as a human, even though he still had trauma, right, and difficulties and challenges, but he was a stronger person as a human than he is as a superhuman vampire. Because as a human, at least he was in charge of his own shit. He had a plan. He's running businesses, you know, in charge of taking care of his family. And whereas as a vampire, where he now has immortal life and superpowers and, you know, a cute boyfriend and all those good things, he is really just dragged down by that.
His trauma, too. You know, one of the traumas that we didn't talk about with Louis is becoming a vampire. And he just doesn't like it. He does not like that life.
Yeah.
And he does now. He engages in that life because, of course, as they're making concessions, he is forced to make the concession that when they hunt human. And so now he's doing that. Louis is a perplexing character to me. And the depth of his sadness is profound.
I look at Louis' trauma in his human life, you know, having to hide who you are fundamentally, who you love, that is traumatic. And then there's the other racial component to it, that the fact that he had to be a black businessman during that time period and dumb himself down to the white man, right? And allow these people to call him, I mean, we saw it in episode one, calls him the N-word, living that life when you are obviously he was a great businessman. He had to pretend to not be great because of the color of his skin. If that's not traumatic, I don't know what is. So he essentially has always had to pretend to be something that he's not. Obviously he can't hide that he's black. So he pretends to be less than because that's the way he gets accepted. He has to pretend to be straight because that's the way he can get accepted. And he's always seeking that acceptance from people. Now, fast forward into his vampiric life, he does not want to be the killer that Lestat and Claudia are. He's more than happy, and we see it because in 2022, he's still doing it, eating animals. He just wants to be left alone. I think it's caused some trauma in his vampiric life of having to be something that he's not to, yet again, please somebody else. Here he is trying to please Lestat. When he finally gives in again after Lestat comes back, he's not doing it this time for Lestat. He's doing it for Claudia because Claudia says she feels judged, that he's a little judgy about the way that she feeds. So pushes Lestat's feelings aside because Lestat has been saying this for years and years and says, fine, Claudia feels that way. I'm, you know, and I said it in the episode six, when she says that he could not have gotten off that bench faster to go eat that guy. And it's still so true. And he tries, a lot of his trauma comes from being a people pleaser and just wanting everybody to accept him. That's kind of my take on the Louis trauma.
And by the way, I believe that Claudia and Lestat's complaints about that are unjustified. There's really not much in the show other than Louis has chosen to live a certain way, but he's never told them, don't go eat people, right? Or you're bad for eating people.
Well,
has he?
No, he never says that maybe exactly, but he does kind of shit on Lestat for the way that, remember, like with the tenor, he hated him for the way he toyed with the tenor, you know, things like that. So he is a little bit on a high horse, Louis.
Well, I think. I mean, he's on a high horse about torturing and murdering. So,
but that's their nature. Is that
Lestat makes things very theatrical, and Claudia takes things way when she was a teen, you know, young and still a teenager in her head. She went way overboard in her own depression. Oh, you know, the other trauma that we didn't talk about is that she killed her first boyfriend.
I mean, that is probably it's not a great date.
No, it was not. That didn't end well. So,
how do you think Charlie felt about it?
Yeah,
Charlie felt fine at the time. Yeah. It was working for him, and then it wasn't.
And until it wasn't. I think that Louis, he does judge the torture part of it, but I don't think that he judges the eating people part
of it. Let's
he
look at it.
He realizes that has to happen.
Let's look at it in the natural analogy, which is, let's say Louis's a vegan. Right. Mm-hmm. And his friends aren't. He doesn't go around saying, I'm a vegan all the time. He just is a vegan. He's not saying don't eat meat, but maybe don't kill the cow and carve the steaks on my table. You know what I mean? Like maybe don't torture the cow before you
don't eat. Don't carve the steaks out of the cow while they're living.
Right. So maybe that would be a reasonable you know, compromise. Because he's not really going around telling them, don't eat people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, again, I thought that was a bit unfair of those little whiny bastards to complain about that. But, you know, it is what it is.
Claudia has elements. They've influenced, they both influenced her. Right. Louis, I just heard a podcast today, someone talking about this. They were actually thinking about collaborating with them on something coming up on Vampire Insider. But they were talking about the show and they mentioned how Louis's influence seems to have been that, you know, like Claudia likes to learn and Claudia likes to read. Well, so this is the influence that he's had on her. She differs from Louis in that she wants to go out and learn. And right. Louis is perfectly happy.
He's a homebody.
Sitting in the house, letting papers stack up and rats crawl around because he's going to eat them anyway.
He's like, I got a whole set of Funkin' Wagnalls back at the pad.
Yeah, because that right? poor, that encyclopedia salesman guy got killed.
Was a wealth of reference books. But,
so, and we know that Lestat's desire for education, at least at this time, is more superficial.
Yeah,
Louis says, you read the first page of the book.
Right.
And then,
I wanted to think people to think I'm educated.
Yeah.
He'd be Google smart.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, but Claudia takes after Louis in that way. But when they're sitting there next to him on that park bench, they're both stone cold killers.
Yeah.
And they enjoy it.
Oh, yeah.
And,
no doubt.
And so there's where she's like Lestat, you know, and she also, Claudia, controlling.
Oh, absolutely. I think I took some heat from this maybe in some of the Twitter threads or something, or maybe somebody just DM'd us or something. But to say that when I said that Claudia is manipulative, and I know there's a lot of, you know, justification for that. It's like, look where she is. I'm like, I'm not saying that she doesn't, you know,
she has to
have the right to be manipulative or whatever, but she definitely is.
Yeah.
Oh, and they're right too. It's, you know, she is manipulative. However, she's been through a lot. That doesn't take away, you know, both things
Correct.
Can be true.
Absolutely.
And she's definitely manipulative.
All right. Let's round out this segment with a talk about Daniel's trauma.
So let's just talk about show Daniel.
Yeah.
Right.
That's all
for now.
Yeah.
Okay. So clearly he's definitely got some very human kind of traumas. He's had broken relationships. He was a drug addict, has this kind of trauma that keeps bubbling up that has something to do with Louis and Rashid / Armand that he's dealing with. He had this initial interview that's clearly caused him no end of angst and anxiety, and he's dying, right? He has Parkinson's. He's on his way out. That can be somewhat traumatic, I understand. But he's also very cynical, and maybe that's just a reflection of where he is in his life, you know, having been a hard-bitten investigative reporter kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's carrying around a lot of stuff. I think he's got some guilt over his children, and that's why, you know, he's like looking to get paid so he can at least leave them money,
mm-hmm.
if not, you know, to make up for the fact that maybe he was a shitty dad. And it clearly impacts how he interacts with Louis and Rashid. Right now, he's so kind of at the end of his rope. He's reckless, right? And his trauma is causing him to behave recklessly. He slapped a supernatural being across the face, right? Like, that's pretty ballsy. Like, I wouldn't slap like a big muscular guy across the face, much less one with, you know, super speed power. And I'm, you know, on their menu. So there's no slapping.
No.
For me.
Right, right. He's interviewing the most dangerous man in the world.
Yeah. And slapped him.
And slapped
in the face.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to expand any further than what Mark just did, because at this moment in time in the story, we don't know all that much really about Daniel other than what Mark just said. And I think that the trauma of knowing that he's going to die, his mortality, looking at two immortal beings, has kind of like pushed him to the edge, I think. And he's just in his, I don't give a fuck era. And does slap him. And not only is there the physical aspect of it, but he mouths off to them from the jump.
Very sassy.
Fucking calls Rashid the rent boy.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, Daniel, that's your ex-boyfriend. Calm down, man.
He just doesn't know it yet. But no, it's I think Mark really painted the best trauma picture of Daniel that we're going to get based on what we know. I think it'd be kind of fun to revisit it once his memories are restored and we know, in this version of the story anyway, what happened in the love triangle of him, Louis, and Armand.
Okay, so here's what I would say about Daniel. He has his own traumas that he's dealing with, and I think that maybe one of them might be something similar to Louis in that he's not maybe being 100% honest about his sexuality, and maybe he hasn't really kind of come to terms with that.
He would seem to have come to terms with it back in the day.
But do we know that now? We don't know.
We don't know it, but because they talk about his marriages.
Right. And but he also, remember when they flash back to the bar, he's like, if something happens, man, hey, that's cool.
That's cool. Right. I'm cool. Yeah. And I get that. But maybe then obviously later in his life, maybe he's bisexual. I don't know. I can't make guesses about his sexuality, but perhaps that's on the menu for his trauma. But here's what I think. He is an investigative journalist. He has, if you look at like his library of work, he's done some very serious stuff, and he's been witness to trauma. He's been, he's seen
war zones,
shit,
and
right?
Famine and whatever.
And now he's sitting here listening to this story with this guy who's telling this story, and it is a traumatic story, and I think that he is on the edge. I think that all of this that he's hearing, like, imagine what that's like. You're sitting there, and now you know that vampires are fucking real.
Yeah.
I know, Joanne, that would excite you.
Joanne's like, I knew it.
I'm not going to be shocked.
Daniel is very, very strident about criticizing Louis for kind of his going back to the abuser, Stockholm syndrome. Mm. Do you think Daniel was either that guy or maybe the other guy, and maybe he was abusive, but he is very fixated on that dynamic, right?
That's an excellent point.
If you go,
it's a good point.
One of the, not always, of course, but a lot of times, the thing people are most focused on, they're either have experienced or have perpetrated it.
So now, if we do bring in Devil's Minion.
Let's do it. He's definitely a victim.
Then there is trauma there that he, right now, he's not really remembering on the surface. But when you read, like, there's a lot that's going on unconsciously here too, right? So especially for Daniel, who we know that probably something has gone haywire with his memories, because Louis keeps asking him,
did you
have another dream? And it's like he's waiting for Daniel to wake up, like, figure it out, man, you know? And so Daniel has this kind of on again, off again, kind of weird stalking thing where Armand says to him, take off. If I catch you, I'll probably kill you, right? Yeah. That's how that all starts out. And so Daniel's on the run.
Yeah.
And then Armand keeps showing up
Almost a Dread Pirate Roberts thing. Thank you for reading the story. I'll most likely kill you in the morning.
Yes, exactly. So that could be, but Daniel always goes, Daniel wants to go back. Daniel goes back. He always seems to come back to Armand, you know, especially when he's in trouble. And then at the end, he's begging Armand to turn him during that time. Interesting, Mark. You may have uncovered something there.
So another thing I've uncovered that you're now going to roll your eyes at me for, the song Daniel by Elton John.
Yeah.
Was written in 1973.
Oh, so are you saying that Elton John?
I think Elton John is a vampire.
He's our mom.
I mean, he does have that kind of weird celebrity youth thing at all times.
Yeah.
And of course, there's this lyric here. Oh, it looks like Daniel. It must be the cloud gift in my eyes.
Wow.
Okay, it didn't say cloud gift, but it's clouds.
Oh, God.
I made up that part.
Wow.
That would be shocking, though, wouldn't it?
I was like, Jesus Christ, what the hell?
He's got the cloud gift.
Oh, good Lord.
All right.
How do we want to wrap this all up?
These people are a bundle of traumas and neuroses and psychoses. I definitely think they're made for each other. I think this is going to work out in the end. They're going to be a nice, happy family, and they're going to settle down together.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's going to work out.
All right, Joe, what about you?
Yeah, definitely our main characters have all in one way or another experienced some massive levels of trauma in their human life and in their vampire life. And there's only more to come. So I'm excited to see that. And I want more of the blanket.
Yes, we know that.
Well, actually, in this case, I should say I want less of the blanket in that scene. I'd like,
just give it a little tug. Just a little tug. Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit less of it, about an inch or two lower. I also really loved the campy tickets, please moment. And I really hope that this season coming up, we get another, obviously not too much, but a moment or two of, you know, something else like that, where we're like, what about that moment with the head and tickets, please? You know, like, that's the fun thing for me. And it kind of breaks up some of the sorrow of the story of these characters, because at the end of the day, there's no happy endings here. Nobody is excited to be the vampire. Nobody's loving their lives. It's a sad story. So when we have those little glimmers of fun, it really, you know, lends a lot to the story. And the way they do it is appropriate. It's not jumping the shark. It's perfect. So I'm excited to see what trauma lies ahead for our beloved characters.
Well, and there's going to be a lot. I mean, in season two, we are definitely going to get a lot more trauma, but you know, Lestat said, hey, look, I like to laugh. This is what Lestat likes to run from his trauma and just like put big band-aids over it and just to be kind of, you know.
What's wrong with that? Nah,
but I just don't like how on earth how is Louis going to be anything? Because, you know, the second half, the Paris half, it's not like suddenly you get happy Louis.
It doesn't work out that great.
It doesn't. It goes really from bad to worse for Louis. The trauma.
He gets a new boyfriend. You know.
Look, the trauma, the big trauma for Louis, and we know that it's coming. It's just not been talked about in the series yet. No one said, this is what happens. Claudia dies.
Right.
But we know reading the book, Claudia dies.
Yeah.
And in a very bad way, and in a way that is really manufactured by Armand.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, there's just going to be this very, I can't stand the thought. Actually, now I really can't stand the thought of Claudia dying in season two. This is going to be very, very hard.
In my mind, she doesn't. So don't worry about it. I am still holding on that they aged her up so that she doesn't have to die, and all that other stuff is bullshit. It's just so that they didn't have to kill her. Mark, don't say it.
We're going to die.
I'm afraid that, you know, obviously she has to for this trauma, for this. This is a tragedy. It's not like at any point in season two, you're going to go, okay, now we're going to get a happy ending. What could possibly be the happy ending? Mm-hmm. Now, it moves on.
Well, from, it could become a rock music video star.
Well, it moves on, but there's always that weight of all of these, you know, even when Lestat's a rock music video star, he's still got Claudia's blood is on his hands, you know, and he has some guilt around that. Season two is going to be a lot. It is going to be heavy.
We should just switch our focus to Mayfair witches. I'm sure that'll work out.
I don't think so.
No, but you know what we could focus on? Maybe like, do we think Claudia is going to be killed in the same way that she was in?
I think so.
I think that there's going to be a trial that's done on stage. I think that they're going to play that trial out.
I bet you they behead her.
Yeah, no, I think they're going to burn her. But I think
burn her.
I think that they're. I think it's going to. The trial is going to be done on the state. Just a guess. I think that's what's going to happen. But yes. Okay. Well, here we are.
That was fun.
That was fun. That was a good conversation. Okay.
Nothing brightens your day more than discussing other people's trauma.
Trauma. I love it.
Makes you, you know, I feel really good about my own trauma in life right now. You should too. We all should.
Yeah.
All right, Joe, you want to take us out?
Thank you guys for listening to our recap, deep dive up into episode 6 of Like Angels Put in Hell by God. If you enjoyed us, please remember to share us with your friends. You can follow us on Twitter at @vampire_insider. You can find Mark at Mark Eats Peach. Christina is at Christina Gen X. Thank you guys and have a good night. Good night, Christina. Good night, Mark.
Good night.
Peace out, Cub Scouts.